Hello, folks. It's Arjorie here on Why We Do the Work. I hope you all are doing fantastic out there. From the jump, I'd like to thank Beyond Toxics for sponsoring this show. And why don't you go ahead and take a hop, skip, and a jump over to beyondtoxics.org, where you can meet the rest of the team and learn about our work as an organization. And of course, a big thank you to producer and editor of the show, Crystal Abrams. Speaking of Crystal, join me in congratulating her on her new role at Beyond Toxics. She is our programs director. Congratulations, Crystal. Actually, at BT, we have quite a few changes happening. After 25 years of leading the growth of the organization to successes that we have accomplished, Lisa Arkin is retiring. Lisa, you will be truly missed, not just as the ED of Beyond Toxics, but for your tenacity in everything involving environmental and climate justice throughout Oregon. I had the pleasure of speaking candidly with Lisa on episode 8 of the show. If you have not heard it, give episode 8 a listen. We go into depth about how she came to work in the field of environmental justice and what fuels her passion to do this work. Thank You skims the surface of how appreciative I personally am for her seeing something in me that I did not see in myself. I never thought that I would be public speaking or sharing the same seat with folks who make the laws that are there to protect human health. Never imagined I would be sitting in the office of former Mayor Venice or Senator Manning discussing the immediate need for environmental, climate, and racial justice. But here I am. Thank you, Lisa. We also have new teammates at Beyond Toxics. Welcome, Alex and Meredith. Along with that, we have a new executive director. Jen Davis joined our team on June 2nd. Welcome, Jen. We're happy to have you join forces with us here at Beyond Toxics. Last episode, I sat and chatted with two friends I have made during my work in West Eugene. Lisa and Eric Dion shared the space with me to talk about Eric growing up literally on Baxter Street in West Eugene, cancer, and how J.H. Baxter completely changed their lives. It was very important for me to share this platform with them. They have been in the media an extraordinary amount, but never got to sit and really tell their story. It was powerful for all of us. Talking to someone who knows and understands the devastation of a cancer diagnosis is special. Big trigger warning for that episode, as we do go into a great deal about how cancer has changed their lives. As always, if cancer triggers you, please take care of yourself. On today's episode, I will be chatting with Joel Eboah. Joel is the founding executive director of OJTA. And dare I say, the reason EJ and CJ are even a discussion in our communities. We are in coalition and work closely with OJTA, which that acronym stands for Oregon Just Transition Alliance. Before we get into your work, Joel, let's give the folks some background. Joel grew up in Eugene in the Whittaker area. And for context, folks, Whittaker is on the edge of Trainsong, which is in West Eugene.
Thank you so much for the intro, Arjorie. You know, I was born and raised here in Eugene. I worked at Beyond Toxics for quite some time. And then I also, you know, work for Oregon Just Transition Alliance. We consider ourselves an alliance of communities across the state that are on the front lines of economic exploitation, on the front lines of climate change, and, you know, on the front lines of a lot of injustices. So we fight hand in hand with groups like Beyond Toxics and other groups across the state to make sure that we have racial justice, to make sure that we have economic justice, to make sure that we have climate justice.
Mm-hmm. So when you were growing up in the Whittaker, I like to read about people before I talk to them.
Yeah.
I like to know what some of the things are that they did, what kind of sparks them into wanting to do this. And I saw that you saw a train derailment, and I'm going to talk a little bit more about sure. that. But first, I'm wondering if seeing that in the Trainsong neighborhood, seeing that over there, did that have anything to do with your decision to do the work that you do now?
I think it reinforced my decision. The derailment happened a little bit after I started working at Beyond Toxic. So I was already doing environmental justice work. I think a lot of what sparked my passion for environmental justice, you know, as I mentioned, the Whitaker is at the edge of, I think, the beginning of an EJ neighborhood. Mm-hmm. But I have always called the Whitaker EJ-esque. Like, because okay. EJ-esque because, you know, the train tracks do run through the Whitaker. The edge of the Whitaker is the beginning, which is a lot of storage of rails. There's a lot of shops that work on cars. And then, of course, there's the I-105, which splits the Whitaker down the middle. So the Whitaker, since I think the I-105 was finished, that's when it made it into sort of what I would call like a baby EJ neighborhood. Because mm-hmm. when it comes to EJ neighborhoods, you know, there's everything from a couple highways, maybe a few car shops, to you know, having oil refineries or J.H. Baxter's in your backyard. So I think there's there's a range, you know, there's a spectrum of like what constitutes an EJ neighborhood. And I think the Whitaker exemplifies the beginnings of what would constitute an EJ neighborhood.
Yeah.
I think that in of itself kind of influenced me, because the other part of it is like the Whitaker, yes, it has some car shops. Yes, it has the train tracks and the highway. And also it's right next to Skeeter's Butte. It's mm-hmm. right next to the Willamette River and all the bike paths. And so we kind of have this like perfect mix of what you would consider a really thriving community with nature and green space and, you know, trees that capture CO2 and a highway that violently cuts the neighborhood right through the middle, and a couple of smaller shops and lower levels of industry. But again, that's kind of how you, that, but then as you go deeper and deeper into West Eugene, you know, you pass the Chambers Bridge and you come into Train Song. Mm-hmm. That's when the real fun begins, I guess you could say.
Yeah. I actually really love Whitaker. I think it's a cute little area. Some of the homes there are little cottages and stuff, and I think it feels really it feels comfortable there. My oldest daughter actually used to live in the Whitaker, and we would go there to visit her and of course my grandson and all that. And we would always walk the neighborhood. And I think it's really cool because there are murals and different things that folks have tried to put out there to make it more inviting. I mean, I think a lot of people are thinking, oh, the Whitaker, you know, the Wit, calling it that. And it's growing, it's thriving, and it has those food trucks there. Like, that was something that I really got excited about, to go see my daughter, because I would always get catfish at the carts right there. And so
soul food.
Yes. So I'm glad that you went into a little bit about that, because we don't talk a whole lot about it, about Whitaker on the show.
Yeah, but it's interesting, Audrey, because again, I think, you know, when I was a kid and I went to Whitaker Elementary when it was still open, when I eventually went to Buena Vista for Spanish immersion in elementary school and even in middle school, right? If you told folks you lived in the Whitaker, they were like, oh, the Whitaker's a dangerous place.
Mm-hmm.
And it did look really different than it does today. You know, back then it was a place, and there was a massive boom in immigrants into the Whitaker, Train Song, and West Eugene neighborhoods. And so when I talk about EJ-esque, you know, I think part of what I'm talking about is because in the 90s, the Whitaker was, the streets were worse. There wasn't really a beer scene or a food cart scene. Mm-hmm. And it was a really affordable place to live. And so, you know, my parents moved there because it was a place they could afford. But as mm-hmm. the years went by, a lot of the boom in the 90s of immigrant communities and Latinx families, you know, if you take a look at the stats now versus back then, the Whitaker still has a lot of Black and brown folks, mm-hmm. but not as much as they did in the 2000s and 90s. And I think in large part, it's because of, you know, repaving the roads. And, you know, there used to be a Whitaker Safety Station, which is now the home of Taco War. and there was a lot of migrant-owned businesses right on Fifth and Blair, and now there's none. You have to cross Sixth to get to the only remaining Mexican store on that block. But I guess the point I'm trying to make is as time has gone on, a lot of the families that were in the Whitaker were pushed to Trainsong and West Eugene as the Whitaker has sort of brightened up its appearance, and you know, with the breweries and the shops and the food trucks, and like, not, you know, it's become quite it's been gentrified a little bit.
Yeah. It's, you know, I don't think I really saw it back in the 90s. I did live out in West Eugene. I moved out in West Eugene as a teenager, and that's going to bring me to the next question. Like, what is your connection with the rest of Eugene? Like, we have Trainsong, we have Whitaker, we have these little pockets. What is the rest of, what is your connection to the rest of Eugene, and what does that have to do with you and Beyond Toxics?
Yeah, for sure. I think that's part of what I was mentioning, right? Like, there's the tale of two Eugenes. So if you look at a map, Eugene is what I would consider to be a quadrant city. And so it's kind of like a four square, right? You've got a perfect square, and then you divide that into four. So if you were to take a pen and paper and you draw a square, and then you draw a cross right between it, you get four quadrants. At the beginning, in the middle of the quadrant is downtown. And then the Whitaker is kind of inhabiting a portion of that. But in that quadrant, I would say on the left side, you know, there is, if you were, the line, Eugene's interesting because Eugene doesn't perfectly align north-south. It kind of tilts at an axis because I-5, everything to the left of I-5 is Eugene. Everything to the right of I-5 is Springfield. So technically West Eugene would be, if you orient yourself northwest, but there's a line, like I said, that the chambers divide the city. And really, once you pass Chambers, whether it be on the expressway or the Chambers Bridge, like the Chambers Bridge descends you into the beginning of West Eugene, which is the Trainsong neighborhood, which is again. So for me, I grew up in the Whitaker, but the majority of my family when I was growing up in the 90s and 2000s. Lived in Trainsong. And so while I didn't live in Trainsong, I spent a lot of time growing up in Trainsong. I think they're the maple apartments right next to the train tracks. If you come down the Chambers Bridge, right at the edge of 99, there's a train tracks, but right before those train tracks, there's this apartment complex, and that's where I had an aunt, some cousins, my uncle, my other uncle lived a little bit down the street, but again, right in Trainsong. So I spent a lot of childhood in Trainsong, which, you know, now when I grew up, found out was the way it was, and so polluted and a food desert. So that was my first exposure to EJ was, you know, I would make the drive or down the Chambers Bridge and descend into Trainsong, which, you know, we would play out in the front yard. I don't think we ever went to that park. The park that was next to that. I think, what did they do? Didn't they do like wood treatment or something next to that park that was eventually shut down? But we never went there. And I think, I'd like to think that maybe my aunt or uncle, I've never asked them about this. Maybe they went and they were like, it kind of smells weird here, but we usually just play out in the front. I don't think we ever would play in the park. But again, I remember wandering those streets with my cousins, and it was hot and a lot of concrete and trains. And, you know, it wasn't the Eugene that I think a lot of folks see and talk about, which is a great, you know, the motto of Eugene is a great city for the arts and outdoors. You know, for me in the Whitaker, that was the case. But when I would go with my cousins, whether my parents, you know, left with my aunts and uncles to babysit me, I didn't have access to that river, to those paths. It was a lot of concrete and history. So,
yeah, it's, you know, I've talked a lot about, you know, just not just with my coworkers, but in different presentations and stuff. And as far as there being two Eugenes, which is really, really sad. And I took offense to it a lot of times when people would say stuff like, oh, West Eugene, you know, way out there in West Eugene. Mm-hmm. And ew, West Eugene, you know, it stinks. I don't want to go all the way out there, industrial area. Mm-hmm. You know, I would take offense to it, but I myself was calling it the industrial area because that's what everybody was calling it.
Right.
But as I started to do this work, I was like, okay, this is, it opened my eyes to how different West Eugene is from let's say East Eugene or
yep. like or South, yeah,
or South Eugene. You know, it made me say, oh gosh, wow, this really is something different out here. And it's not necessarily that it's bad different, but it's just really super polluted. And you know, there's more trees there now than there were when I lived there in the 90s, but
it's still not enough, you know.
Still not enough.
Yeah.
No.
Yeah.
Still not enough.
If you take a look,
so you still have family that lives in West Eugene?
Yes.
You still have some family that live there?
Yeah, so it's interesting. So like I said, growing up I had an aunt and two uncles who lived in Trang Song. And then in the 2000s, late 2000s, they all left that area. But then eventually, you know, now their kids, so my cousins, I have a lot of cousins who live in West Eugene.
Mm-hmm.
They've got spouses and kids, and they all work either in sawmills or, you know, and other industry related work. And that's an affordable place to live. So I have, you know, three, four cousins who live in West Eugene, and that's where they were able to afford a house.
Yep.
So, but they live closer to Barger, you know, over by the Winko and Echo Hollow.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, it's not as in your face as Trang Song is, but it's still in the middle, sandwiched between two major zones of industry. There's 99 and then there's 11th, right? So all the stuff north of 11th and all the stuff west of 99 kind of traps West Eugene in this plume of smoke and industry and all these other things and concrete. So I do still have family out there, and then they have kids. So not only do you have a sort of my parents' generation who lived there for quite some time, and my cousins who lived there for quite some time, but now their kids live there.
Yeah. So
I have a lot of nieces and nephews that are out in West Eugene. And like I said, the rest of my family lives in either in Junction City or West Eugene, but
mm-hmm.
I have a lot of extended family still in West Eugene.
I lived all throughout West Eugene. So I lived off Barger and Echo Hollow. I lived over close to Highway 99 over by Jess and Ponds. I lived in always in West Eugene, just sort of in a semicircle around all of that pollution. And I was so blind to it because right. It was just normal. So I'm going to get into a little bit about your work now.
Yeah.
It's exciting. And I've seen your name all throughout the Beyond Toxics West Eugene Drive. I've seen your name in there. I've met you around in places. And I have a lot of admiration for you. So thank you very much for sitting down and talking to me.
I'd
be remiss if I didn't say how much I admire you.
Thank you, Audrey.
You're welcome. So what, you worked for Beyond Toxics. How long did you work for Beyond Toxics? And how long after that did OJTA start?
Mm-hmm. So I started working at Beyond Toxics in December of 2014. So mm-hmm. over 10 years ago. It's actually the 10-year anniversary just passed of me starting at BT. And I was there for 2 years. So I worked there from December 2014 through February of 2017. So just a little over 2 years I worked at Beyond Toxics. Yeah, it was a it was a wild time to do this work. I think shortly after that, OJTA was formed. So like I said, I switched to the immigrant rights movement after the previous administration was put in place. And a few months after that, OJTA was formed. And they sort of laid the groundwork for OJTA to form right after the People's Climate March that happened that spring. But I actually was at the first Just Transition training that spring, having just left Beyond Toxics. And, you know, it was a program and an alliance within Opal until it went independent in the summer of 2020. And I was brought on, funny enough, also in December. I was brought on December of 2020. I don't know what it is about December, Jenny. I switched jobs. My guess. But yeah,
it's a fresh start. You're looking for a fresh start of the new year.
So summer of 2020, OJTA sort of makes a decision to become its own organization. And then December of 2020, I got brought on as a founding executive director.
Nice. That's a good jump. That's a really big, good jump. I am learning a lot more about what it is that we do in coalition with OJTA. Again, folks, it's Oregon Just Transition Alliance. And as my role is changing a little bit at BT, I am wanting to get closer to you all as I'm up here in Portland. I know you're down in Eugene, but I know that your team is up here. But could you tell me and the folks a little bit, you shared a little bit in the start, but what is Just Transition? What is that?
So Just Transition is it's a framework in which to understand, I guess, a lot of what we're facing. You know, so it's interesting that Just Transition can be explained in an hour, but it also can be explained in a training of 7 days. Mm-hmm. So we don't have that much time. But
give me the synopsis.
But I will say that I think at its core, a just transition is about shifting the way the world operates from a system that really is exploiting people and exploiting the planet to a world in which people and the planet are treated with dignity and respect. And the way that's done is through a variety of meta strategies and really is work that's going to take generations to do. And I can name some of those sort of core strategies, but everything from, you know, fighting bad things like pollution, like the work that Beyond Toxics does, right? Like fighting the bad is a core strategy for a just transition. So let's stop the harm. Let's stop the bleeding. So the work against J.H. Baxter is a perfect example of fight the bad. There's change the rules. And I think that one points to legislative work, the policy work, Beyond Toxic Studs, that OJTA does in coalition. There's change the story. So again, how do we change hearts and minds? How do we get folks to realize the harm and chaos that's often caused by greed and hoarding of resources? I think the big piece around a just transition is around building the new. So I think for a long time, a lot of environmental justice, what makes environmental justice and a just transition different is that as a lot of EJ is focused on fighting the bad, changing the rules, like let's just stop the bleeding. Whereas the just transition really begs the question, okay, well then what? What are the things that we're actually building? What are the new things that we're doing that's going to usher in this world that doesn't exploit people, it doesn't exploit the planet. And that can look from everything from community resilience hubs to weatherization efforts to, you know, community gardens to storing energy in response to extreme weather events. Like the build a new work is, I think, at the core of a lot of just transition. And the last two areas are on moving the money. I think there's a big recognition that a lot of resources are being hoarded. And so a core tenet of the just transition is how do we move the money, not just to nonprofits, but also to in the hands of the community members who built all this wealth that's not coming back to them, right? So that could look everything from, you know, how do we get that? Oh, so a lot like economic justice for workers, for communities that historically been disinvested or underinvested in, or in which the work that they've helped do, that wealth is not being shared with them. And the last tenet of a just transition is around building the bigger we. So there's a reason why we say racial, economic, and climate justice. It's easy to get really bogged down in fighting the bad or reducing greenhouse gas emissions, but the just transition framework begs the question, how do we build a movement of movements that includes, yes, environmental justice advocates, but also includes, you know, our environmental friends, our folks in labor, people in the racial justice or reproductive justice movement, like there are much, or our housing, like there are immigration. There's a responsibility in the just transition framework to build a bigger we, to build a bigger tent of folks that say we're all in this together. So as you can see, it's a lot. It's a lot.
Yeah. Yeah. It's beautiful though. Like I'm learning in just this little short conversation that you gave me right there about what just transition is. I went to a retreat and I loved it. I loved forming those connections with folks, but that was my really, you know, my work has been so much in West Eugene that I didn't really have an opportunity yet to be in coalitions with folks like you all. Right. And so when I went to, and not that that doesn't mean everybody, not, I'm not saying Beyond Toxics, I'm saying me personally. So when I went to the retreat, I didn't really know what I was getting into. I didn't know, I hadn't really learned what Just Transition was. I obviously knew about OJTA, but I was never in any meetings with you all. I think the first interaction that I had with you was actually not even face-to-face. It was during, I think it was the 20-year anniversary, and we did a video talking about West Eugene, and we did it in segments. So you were on one part, and I was on another part. And I really just love a full circle moment because that was my very first start at Beyond Toxics. And so being in that video with you without actually being in that video with you, this feels like a full circle moment to me. So I really appreciate that.
Yeah, no, and
learning more.
To chat.
What was that?
No, I agree. I'm really excited to be having this conversation with you.
Yeah. Yeah. I think it's, I think we sound good because there's not, I think we both feel comfortable with a microphone and, this is an easy conversation. So I appreciate that.
Yeah, of course.
So what is the Oregon Green New Deal, later named Oregon Clean Energy Opportunity? What is that? I was reading a little bit about it, but I don't really know what that is.
That's a really great question. So the Green New Deal policy platform is a product of a much larger conversation. So before OJTA became its own organization, there was FLOR, FLOR, the front, and it stands for Frontline Leaders Organizing Rising Cohort. And that was formed back in 2019. There was a growing national conversation about the need for a Green New Deal. You know, the New Deal was formed right after the Great Depression in an attempt to get Americans back to work, but also get Americans a lot of the basic protections that we really like today, the 40-hour work week, you know, Medicare, Medicaid, Social Security, like a lot of those things were developed because of the New Deal. And so nationally, there's this idea of like a Green New Deal. And so at the time, OJTA had an energy justice work group, and they developed sort of a first draft of a Green New Deal platform of strategies to address the multiple crises that were affecting Oregon, from like economic quality to environmental climate disruptions to like a rising threat of white nationalism and white supremacy. And so in 2020, leaders of OJTA and the FLOR cohort thought about and were planning a statewide listening tour. Mm-hmm. To talk directly with frontline community members, with, you know, the community members that our collective org served, to help shape a policy agenda. And so the Frontline Leaders Organizing Rising cohort was a group of 10 organizations from across the state that were going to come together over 10 months to sort of build shared analysis, deepen relationships, and to build a collective vision for a just transition. Now, those groups were many, and Beyond Toxics is one of those 10 organizations. And actually, Anna Molina represented Beyond Toxics on that cohort. So the idea was, you know, the first quarter of 2020, like two monthly webinars, and then have a little retreat. And then in the summer of 2020, to have these listening tour conversations across the state. Now, as you and I both know, what actually happened in 2020 was COVID. So that retreat that was supposed to happen in March never actually happened. I'm actually looking at the date right now. March 25th was supposed to be the start date for that three-day retreat. But the governor's shutdown, and I remember the date because it was my brother's birthday, was March 23rd, 2020. Mm-hmm. So what ended up happening is, you know, to make a long story short, instead of having these listening sessions in person, they were shifted to be online. And so they still happened virtually across the state, but that's really what helped those conversations of, you know, 2-3 hours facilitating, having conversations with frontline communities was what birthed the Green New Deal policy platform, which is 10 pillars for a Green New Deal in the state of Oregon, and has been at the core of guiding the way OJTA has approached policy making and campaigns we've taken on the last 4 years. And for us, the initial campaign that we worked on, you know, was around the clean energy opportunity. That's one of the pillars for the Green New Deal we developed. And that's how the Oregon Clean Energy Opportunity Campaign was born, was because of all this work that we had done as an alliance to hear from our community members about what was really important. And so after that summer and the development of the Green New Deal policy platform, there was also an awareness that because of the economic uncertainty, because of the wildfires, because of COVID, that we needed to try and have a campaign that was focused on providing people relief. And so the three bills in the Clean Energy Opportunity Campaign were 100% clean energy, a low-income utility rate bill, so making sure that low-income folks didn't have to pay as much per kilowatt for their energy, and then also Healthy Homes, which is a fund of now $30 million for renters and from homeowners to do essential home repairs. If it's like leaky doors, windows, mold, asbestos. And the last thing I'll say, Audrey, is like that campaign was the first time that environmental justice advocates were in the driver's seat. We led that campaign. We were on the steering committee, and it was supposed to take us 3 years to do. So when I was brought on, I was told, hey, this is probably going to take us 2 or 3 years to get done. Mm-hmm. But I think we had a perfect storm. I think COVID, I think the platform, OJT going on its own, was just like the perfect storm. And we got it done in 1 year. We got it done that session, passed all three policies that session.
Wow. Yikes. Is that the 100% clean energy for all?
Healthy energy homes, affordability, and energy affordability. Those three bills were all passed in one session. And that was also, you know, you got to remember, I came on December of 2020. So the campaign was fully formed. And I came on December 2020 and kind of was told, hey, listen, you're the founding ED of OJTA. And also, by the way, your first job as founding ED of OJTA is going to be being the campaign director for OCEO. So really, my first 6 months were me managing this massive campaign, and doing it in deep alliance and coalition with our member orgs and with the wider climate justice movement. And we got it done.
That's amazing, Joel. Like, you're a superstar. Know that, because that is impressive. Something that was supposed to take so long and you guys just had it lickety split. I'm sure there was a lot of hard work there. I'm not trying to make it sound like it was easy, but wow, that's awesome.
Yeah, it was the other thing I want to mention about this, and I think this is important, is winning is important, but how you win is also important. And I think that was a big part of our success, was that we launched a campaign that was pretty different from your traditional policy campaigns. And I think one function of that was the fact that a lot of environmental justice orgs were on the steering committee and helping steer the ship. I also think it's because we had the Leadership Institute. So many of our member orgs have programs for community members, whether it be youth or elders or just, you know, run-of-the-mill community members to participate in our work. And usually what that looks like is like, okay, well, we're going to have a lobby day and we're going to invite all these people and they're going to come and talk to their legislators and we're going to say thank you and that'll be the end of it. We saw an opportunity that session, and also because it was COVID, to do something much bigger. And so we did the Energy Justice Leadership Institute, and we had staff from across the alliance help staff the institute. We had weekly sessions of an hour and a half with over 100 community members. We gave almost $100,000 in stipends to community members, from our members all across the state, to learn every week, not just how to have a meeting with a legislator, but what a kilowatt was, what a megawatt was, what is the history of our energy system? Mm-hmm. How does this pertain to you? How do you write letters to the editor? How do you do all these things? And it was, I think that's also part of the reason why we were so successful, is that the people who are affected first and worst by the issues that we were trying to talk about, we had weekly conversations with. And they were the ones who were directly talking and testifying with legislators and understood the issues deeply, because we took the time to make sure that they knew as much as they could about these issues.
Wow. That's awesome, Joel. I was getting chills and a little emotional when you're saying that, because I know that it's difficult to get folks involved and want them, teach them to know to care, you know, like, why would you care? So I think it's awesome that you all were able to show folks the reasons why they should care and how to make a change with it. I know that we can't do anything without the community members. And so to have that frontline community be part of the campaign is what it's all about. So,
yeah, like I said, it was a perfect storm. You know, we actually have a Leadership Institute we're running right now. We have a Transportation Justice Leadership Institute, but it's much smaller. You know, I think we have almost 30 folks in it. That was a special time. I think between COVID, everyone having to shelter at home, people were really eager to do this. You know, so we were able to have, I think we had almost 150 people part of it. But again, everyone was stuck at home, and so we had, I think for a lot of folks, this was like a lifeline to for them not to lose their mind, you know, mm-hmm. and so it felt like something they could do, because I'll tell you, you know, doing things in person is a lot more difficult and also a lot less inaccessible for folks that have to travel really far away or have disabilities or have families. And so really, like, this platform of the Leadership Institute being fully remote and the legislature being fully remote really worked to our advantage.
Yeah. COVID was unbelievable to say the least. Like, it was so strange to me that the whole world was going through the same thing at the same time. That was hard for me to get my mind wrapped around. But I do know that it opened up the gate for opportunities that otherwise wouldn't have been there. I do like that there are that there's Zoom, because my whole job has been on Zoom, and I wouldn't have been able to connect with the folks that I connected with, not only in-house, but throughout the community, unless they were able to see a face of someone. So I actually had like Zoom meetings with community members right. so that they can see who this person is that's talking about West Eugene and wanting to make changes there. So COVID was a terrible, terrible time, but it also did birth some opportunities, like you're saying, and it made me able to do this job. So I appreciate you shining a light on that with the work that you all are doing as well. This is leading me into Homes for Good, and this is going to be a two-parter question as well. Can you tell me about Homes for Good and how that ties into climate resilience? And how do you educate participants on climate change and justice?
Yeah, I'm so glad you bring that up. Yeah, so I I'm ED of OJTA, but I was also asked a couple years ago, I think it's been almost 2 years now, to serve on Homes for Good, which is our county housing authority here in Lane County. And I think for me, part of my decision to say yes to that, part of it was really new. So up until 2 years ago, Lane County's governing body for our housing authority, which is Homes for Good, was exclusively run by county commissioners. So you had to be a county commissioner to be able to make decisions about our housing authority. And they changed their governance model and said, you know what, we need to open it up to people who actually live in this community. Not to say our county commissioners don't, but they also have a lot more on their plate. And so I was asked to apply by a former colleague that I served on a different commission, the Human Rights Commission. She was like, hey, I think you'd be really great for this. You should apply. So we had a conversation. She told me a little bit more about what they do. And I said, you know what? I'll put my hat in the ring. We'll see what happens. And yeah, I've served now 2 years on the Homes for Good as the inaugural sort of transition for Homes for Good as a body that still has to be clear. We still have two county commissioners that sit on the governance body on the board of Homes for Good, but now we have community members and two residents that serve on the board as well. So for me, I think housing justice and climate justice are inextricably linked, as the climate crisis worsens on top of what we are already dealing with. Right. So on top of the already rampant economic exploitation and the pollution in people and frontline communities, I think a big factor that has guided a lot of my work this decade has been these extreme weather events. So we had the wildfires in 2020. We had the extreme heat wave in 21 that killed over 600 people across the Northwest. And then we had this awful winter storm last January, I think. So it's often said that yes, housing justice is important and people need to be in homes, but my assessment has been that people's homes are their first line of defense against the climate crisis. And I think there's been a two-dimensional conversation happening in a lot of the housing world. You know, the real estate agents are fighting the renter protection folks. The renter protection folks are fighting the real estate agents, the houseless advocates are fighting those people, the builders want to build more, legislators and elected officials want to do this and that. So that everyone's having this two-dimensional conversation around like, let's keep people in their homes, let's build new homes. But I think a big missing piece of that conversation was, how does the climate crisis and these extreme weather events factor into how we talk about housing? Mm-hmm. And I think policies like the low-income utility rate class and healthy homes, those are housing justice issues. And I think a lot of housing justice advocates don't really think about it, but then when you even just one simple conversation, they're like, oh yeah, that makes sense, right? Because okay, great, we've been focused on having enough housing, keep living in housing, and then what? Mm-hmm. What's the thing that people use the most to keep their homes a livable space? Energy, energy, and also, you know, how do we make the homes strong enough to withstand these extreme weather events? And also, how do we add extra protection to homes that are surrounded by things like J.H. Baxter? So how do we reinforce homes as we're trying to stop all this harm? There's also work to be done to insulate people within their homes from these outside forces.
That's, thank you for going into that. I also am wondering, I'm curious about how many families have been served with this program. Like, do you have any idea with Homes for Good, how many people have been able to benefit from those services?
I mean, Homes for Good serves thousands of people. So it's our county's housing authority. So they own multiple properties across the county. They build multiple projects, housing projects across the community. They do everything from rental vouchers to transitional housing for people experiencing homelessness or addiction. So yeah, there's a lot. There's, I think, over 100 people that work for Homes for Good.
Wow.
Yeah, the agency is massive. And they get money from the state. They get money from the federal government. But the one thing I'm really proud to say about Homes for Good is, you know, Oregon has 36 counties. I don't think there's quite 36 housing authorities. There's some counties that share housing authorities. But I could confidently say that I think there's probably around 24 housing agencies across the state. Homes for Good in Lane County is the only housing authority that has an energy services director, like an energy services department, because Homes for Good has recognized that energy is a massive part of keeping people safely housed.
Yeah.
And I'm really proud of that we have that.
I'm proud that we have that too. I mean, I live in Portland, but, you know, a part of my heart resides in Eugene and always will.
Of course.
What is your vision for our EJCJ front lines? And is HB 3081 One-Stop Shop 2.0 part of that vision?
Absolutely. I think for me, we have the policy platform for a Green Deal. And we have a number of things that we're working on, from transportation to resilience from extreme weather events and other things. But I think this year that our energy affordability package is a big part of that, and House Bill 3081 was a component of that. But I think bigger than that, I actually just we actually just had a letter to the editor posted in the Eugene Weekly this week, in which we were talking about this exact issue. So last weekend, that was the first really hot days of the summer. And we were urging our legislators, you know, to pass the energy affordability package and to pass the resilience package, because part of what's at stake right now is, you know, 2023, we passed what was called the Community Resilience Hub. So it was $10 million for community resilience hubs and networks. And that was so that, you know, for example, Beyond Toxics, if they wanted to, could partner with, a church, or even itself access funds to stock power banks or air conditioners or baby food, like the human side of extreme weather. And that was a really successful program. So CRH had $10 million, over hundreds of applications came in, and now we're asking the legislature to invest more money in it. And we also have a lot of our other energy policies. One of them is the Fair Energy Act. We have seen a really historic rise in utility rates these last 4 years. And unfortunately, you know, for many of us, we live under a system in which even energy is something that is used for profit.
Yeah.
Fortunately for us in Eugene, we have a consumer-owned utility, but a majority of Oregonians operate underneath a utilities that are for profit. And so a lot of the work that we have done has been, well, you know, how do we curtail some of this greed and recognize that energy is a fundamental right for Oregonians, and that frontline communities who are already struggling right now with a lot of economic uncertainty, with a federal government that is taking away investments, you know, how do we make sure we hold these utilities accountable? And also, how do we make sure that Oregonians are protected during these extreme weather events? So whether it be shutoffs or, you know, high utility rates, or all the programs we've done, even around like heat pumps and other weatherization efforts. How do we protect all those things, especially as we have a federal government who is not going to invest in the way the previous administration did in our state?
Could you tell me about the House bill that you were talking about, the Clean Energy Act?
It was for a number of bills that we had around just energy affordability. So we had 3179, 3564, 3792. There's a number of bills that we're working on, but I think the one that we're most excited about right now is 3179. That was the Fair Energy Act. So basically makes it so that, as I mentioned, you know, like Oregon's largest utilities have raised people's billing rates by almost 50% since 2021. And while there are some programs available to like help people keep up, like it's just not enough. And so the bill 3179 that I'm talking to you about empowers state regulators to help families avoid big energy bills. And it also, you know, works on making sure that we have more flexibility to use low cost financing for important investments. And also having transparency, right? Like, how do we have transparency that consumers know what they're paying for and what to expect from any changes in their energy bills? The bill that you're talking about was just making sure it was a one-stop shop. And the one-stop shop was really focused on, you know, there was a one-stop shop 1.0 back in 23, but this year we're trying to pass a 2.0 because, you know, there's all these programs, whether it be state or federal, and it's really difficult to navigate. Like, if you're a homeowner, and then if you're a renter, it's even more difficult to navigate. But that program basically was put in place to try and make sure that people had one place where they could go and say, you know, how can I access all these programs and benefits and not have to spend all these hours doing research and the time I don't have? So our work this year around energy was really focused on affordability and access.
Yeah. I when I went with Jamie, I went to a hearing with her about this. And I have given testimony for, and I've talked to Crystal about this and maybe someone else, but I've given testimony before at city council and things like that for Eugene. And most of it has been, or all of it has been online. And so, or written. And so I was excited to go to a hearing and sit there and kind of read the room, because I had never actually been in the room during those events. So I'm sitting there and I take it all in. I watch everything. And so I'm reading the room, I'm looking at people's faces. There's two people that go up first to talk about their needs. And one was for South Eugene High School needed something. And they were talking about how their football team won and all this, which, great job, South Eugene. I'm not putting you down. I'm just talking about it. And the whole, you know, the people that were up there, the panel that was there was super excited and chipper and, oh, wow, that's great. And that sounds fantastic. And passed it, whatever it was that they were asking. So I was like, okay, that's good. Another person came up and they were talking about University of Oregon and their baseball needed something or something. I don't know. I was reading the room to see the reaction of the people. And so they were excited about that. Yay. Yes, you can have that money. You can do whatever you want with it. So I'm thinking, this is great. Jamie is in a good spot. These people are in a good mood. It's all lighthearted. The room feels great. As soon as she sat down and she started talking about the hard stuff, which is the people, people's money, people's homes, people's health, people's lives in general. When she started talking about it, I noticed a complete switch. And I was like, wow, I'm witnessing something right now that I've only heard about. Because everybody was in such a good mood to talk about stuff that was easy. Football, peanuts, games. That was easy to talk about. But when they're sitting there and Jamie's talking about housing and bills and people not being able to pay for their bills, and there's a woman there who is testifying about having to choose between heating her house and her husband's medication and things like that. Okay, real stuff, heart stuff, humanity. And I noticed that switch. And so I don't know what made me start talking about that, but I did notice a difference. And it's important for people like us and in the line of work that we do, because I believe that we show the humanity of what is going on in the world. And sometimes that's really hard for people to intake and want to do anything about because it's hard. So can you tell me about winning the 20 under 40? What was that? What happened there?
Oh, yeah. I know Eugene, there's a lot of 20 under 40 programs across the country. So usually it's like, it's either statewide or city or county, it depends where you are. And there's, I think there's a national one, but I know here in Lane County, they've had a 20 under 40 program for a couple of years now. And, I had someone in the community who nominated me. And I got an announcement. You know, I kind of had to answer a few questions, and then I got the news that I had been selected. And I think I was 20. I was 29 or how old was I? I think I was like 30 or 31. I don't remember how old I was. No, I think I still was 29. Yeah, I was 29 years old. So. Wow. I got nominated and got selected to be part of the 40 folks that were selected to basically be recognized in front of the community and in front of other 20 under 40 participants. So yeah, I got to go to a ceremony and they gave me an award, and you know, I did a little interview. And the program is just a recognition of people in our community who are making, I guess, wanted to be the award is for people who are really excelling or advancing things for our community, whether it be in nonprofits or business or whatever field. But it's just a recognition of excellence and of contributions people have made to our community. Mm-hmm. And so every year, if you win a 20 under 40, you are able to nominate someone else. So it was a previous 20 under 40 graduate who put my name in the hat.
I was like, yeah, I get it, Joel. And you're being modest right now. You do a lot and you deserved that. So I'm going to toot your horn a little bit.
Thank you.
Joel, what is the most exciting and rewarding part of the work that you do? What makes you keep on wanting to do it?
I think at this point, I have that's a really great question. I think for me, what makes me really want to keep doing this work is seeing how much is needed. You know, I think oftentimes folks ask me, do you like your job? Do you like this? And I tell folks all the time, like, I like drinking coffee. I like going to the beach. I like riding my bike and rafting. Mm-hmm. I don't know if I like the work.
Right.
I feel responsible for the work. I feel, you know, there's a quote from Prefontaine. And again, you know, as Tracktown USA, I think it's That's a really great quote. And I remember hearing it as a kid, and it stuck with me, you know, which was, he said, like, to give nothing but your best is something along with, like, it's a waste of the gift, it's wasting your gift. And so I think life has shown me that I have the ability to fight and be a champion for folks. And so for me, I think a lot of what keeps me going is a recognition that I have this gift, and it would be irresponsible for me not to use it for my hometown, for our county, for our state, for our country, for the world. I had a mentor tell me one time, he was like, you know, the work can feel overwhelming, things can feel overwhelming, but we have to remember that doing all this is like being in a big band. You know, you have to pick up an instrument, you have to play it. But I think and then hopefully we make some music together. But the problem, I think, for a lot of folks, and for me sometimes, is remembering that, you know, you have to make music with other people. You have to pick up an instrument. And so I think over the years, I picked up different instruments and have been part of different parts of the band, but I still want to make music.
Ooh, I wish you could see this giant smile on my face. I liked that you said, I like to go rafting. I like to drink coffee. I don't like the work, but you didn't mean it like that, folks.
Yeah.
We like to do things that make people better and have a better life.
Yeah.
I like that you said you feel responsible.
Yeah.
Because I do too. I know that we both have gifts, and it would be irresponsible for us to not use those.
Yeah.
I have this gift of gab. I can talk. And I've had some really interesting conversations with folks. But it's something that was put inside of us before we were even thought of yet, that makes us propel and pick up all those instruments in this job. So thank you for picking them up. Thank you for making music with me.
Yeah, of
and
course.
The rest of us. I appreciate you.
And I think it's just, I don't know, Audrey, I think people get so overwhelmed. And I hear all the time, like, what can I do? And I'm just like, you just need to just pick an instrument up, whatever it can be, super small. Like, I think what's really dangerous is apathy and cynicism. And I see a lot of apathy and cynicism in the world. And I think people would be so surprised and shocked to see how much impact they could have if they, you know, to keep using the metaphor, picked up the instrument and just try and play something, whether even if it's just a little sound. Like, I think people really underestimate how much impact they could have if they just tried something, anything.
Yeah.
But the problem is a lot of folks, I think, really underestimate how much can get done by a really small group of people who really care.
Yeah, we're doing it.
I've seen it. I've seen it with my own eyes. I've seen.
Mm-hmm.
I've seen how much, you know, just a little band can make a lot of noise.
This conversation that we're having right now is me picking up an instrument.
Yeah.
I started with a recorder. Now I play a trombone.
There you go.
And I didn't know that that was in there. I didn't know I could make an impact. I didn't know that I was Cheryl up the street that was going to make a difference, because I thought somebody else had it.
Of course. And I also think people forget too that, you know, you don't, that the reason why you play in a band is so that you can have backups, right? So.
Mm-hmm.
That's part of what I think I also feel responsible for at this point in my career and in my journey. You know, it's been about, I was a student activist in college and high school, but, you know, I've been working quote unquote professionally for a decade now. And at this point, I think a lot of what I'm interested, you know, to keep answering your question, a lot of what interests me is like, how do we build a bench? How do I get more band players?
Mm-hmm.
Right? And how do I begin to orchestrate a band that's really cohesive. So I'm like, right now I'm like, hey, I need more folks in the drums, or I need more people, you know, I need more people on the guitar. Like, hey, this part of the band looks like it's, we only have one person and they're getting tired, you know?
So yeah.
Part of this analogy around band playing is like the music has to continue. It doesn't have to be the same players.
Yeah.
And people can take breaks. Mm. You know, you have to, because if you want to keep playing, like you can't play 24/7. You need breaks. No. You need breaks, so you need to practice, and you need to also coach the next generation of people in the band. Mm-hmm. So I think that's kind of where I'm at right now, is wanting to continue to play music, but also how do I get more people to pick up instruments? And I think that's a big part of what the Alliance does is helping more folks come on in and play some music with us, or how can we support you to play your instrument better, or how can we help your organization get more instrument players?
Mm-hmm. Well, you get your family gave us one in Alex, and we're super excited about him. He picked up his instrument.
There you go.
Yeah, I love it. So, Joel, you have done a lot in this field, a lot. So much to read about, so much to see. And I apologize that we won't be able to get to all of your accomplishments.
I'll be here all day.
But one of the many things that stood out to me when I was on the Goog looking up facts about you, but doing so, when I was doing that, I found out that you love The Precious, aka The Lord of the Rings. And I'm assuming also The Hobbit is involved in there, which I love. You can tell I have like a personal relationship with it, calling it The Precious. So being able to have a conversation with somebody that knows all the in and outs of all that whole saga is exciting. Mm-hmm. So I call everybody Precious. I call them like, so oh, funny. Precious. And I just do. That's just my thing. It's my comfort. I put that on and I'm like, okay, this is, yeah. This is it. I don't feel good, or I just want background noise. It's there.
No, that's great.
Yeah.
I love that. Yeah, I love Lord of the Rings.
Yeah. Yeah, me too. But the thing that stood out was that in 2017, and I'm bigging you up here because you deserve it. In 2017, you were the youngest person to be elected chair for the Oregon Governor's Environmental Justice Task Force.
Uh-huh.
What is the Environmental Justice Task Force? And are you still part of it?
Yeah, the EJ Task Force was formed in the late 2000s. I think it was 2008 by then Senator Abel Gordley. Senator Abel Gordley is, I think, one of a few legislators to be a Black woman. And it's interesting you're bringing this out, because Senator Abel Gordley championed the EJ Task Force bill in 2008. And the founding chair of the EJ Task Force was a Black woman, Robin Morris Collin. So Robin Morris Collin was a law professor, and her husband as well, Bob Morris Collin, were both law professors at the U of O in the 80s. And I'm mentioning all these things. I promise you there's a connection here.
No,
so Robin and Bob Morris Collin were U of O law professors in the 80s. And they helped a group of students start the Coalition Against Environmental Racism. And the Coalition Against Environmental Racism is a student group that's still active today, in which many EJ advocates that have gone to U of O have participated in. So I was part of the Coalition Against Environmental Racism in college. Ben Duncan was part of the Coalition Against Environmental Racism in college. Some other EJ champions that are a little older than me were part of it. But the reason why this is important is because when I first started interacting with the EJ Task Force, it was in 2015 when I worked at Beyond Toxics. And I helped organize with some of the members of the EJ Task Force. So at the time, there were people like Ben Duncan and Jonathan Ostar. Jonathan Ostar founded Opal Environmental Justice, which then founded OJTA. So I worked with Jonathan Ostar in 2015 to organize a meeting in Medford for farm workers and forest workers to talk to the EJ Task Force about their experiences with chemical exposure and other workplace injustices. And we had many, many workers come testify to the EJ Task Force. And it was the first time the EJ Task Force in its, you know, I think it had been operating for 7 years at the time, had ever left Salem or Portland, much less gotten testimony from workers, from people. Again, intersection of racial, economic, and climate justice. So that's significant because I spent those 2 years at Beyond Toxics, you know, working with OGs like Jonathan Ostar, like Robin Morris Collin, like Ben Duncan. And then eventually, you know, after so much interfering and doing all these things, they're like, well, why don't you apply to Beyond? So I did. And I got appointed in the fall of 2016. And then about a year later, I got elected to be chair. So I kind of went from like kind of pointing the finger and then also working closely with the leadership at the time to then finding myself in the leadership seat. You can see a common theme here where I kind of start picking up an instrument. And next thing you know, people are like, well, why don't you be the band leader? So I'm trying to be careful about where I play music these days. But I mentioned CARE, I mentioned Ben and Robin, I mentioned Jonathan Ostar because Ben Duncan was chair of the EJ Task Force when I came on. And Ben Duncan was in CARE in the early 2000s, late 90s, when Ben and Robin Morris Collin were U of O professors. And I was part of CARE in the early 2010s as a college student. So you can see here, again, back to this analogy around bands, building the bench, building the bigger we, there's reverberations and strong connections and the EJ movement has a lot of intersections and a lot of titans that help make the foundation for me to do, for this work to be possible for me. Yeah. And just to close the point on that, Robin Morris Collin, who I mentioned was the founding chair, started the Coalition Against Environmental Racism that then Ben joined in the early 2000s and I joined in the 2010s. And then we both found ourselves together on the same committee. She was appointed in the Biden administration to be pretty high up in the Environmental Justice Department for the White House. She was appointed by President Biden to go serve in the White House for environmental justice. Mm-hmm. So you can, I mentioned this task force because it's got a really strong legacy, and the EJ Task Force was the first task force of its kind in the country in 2008. And to answer your question, if I'm still on it, a lot of the work that I did from 17 to now, from 17 to 20 was after that meeting we had in Medford when I became chair, we actually met across the state. So from 17 to 2019, we had every quarterly meetings. And places as far out as Ontario, Astoria, Pendleton, like we went all across the state to hear from communities about environmental justice, which culminated in 2022, we passed the EJ for All bill. And the EJ for All bill was to turn the task force into a council and also to it also helped pass a portion of the bill to create an environmental justice mapping tool. So California and Washington both have an EJ mapping tool. Because of the EJ for All bill and because of the EJ task force turning from a task force to council, we are now in the middle of forming our own environmental justice mapping tool. And I was founding chair of the EJ council. But I just hopped off the EJ Council, I would say, almost a year ago now. I hopped off in the fall after serving as a member and also as chair for 8 years. But I think when I came in, I really wanted to increase the impact of the EJ Task Force. So we did that by passing the bill, and we did that by turning into an EJ Council, and then now we're closely monitoring the development of this EJ mapping tool, which should be coming out pretty soon.
Oh, goodness. So I'm in admiration because you started all this when you were much younger than you are now.
Yeah, I just turned 34.
Well, you look great, but you started all this when you were much younger. And yeah. I think when I was your age during that time, you know, I'm 52 almost,
mm-hmm.
but probably, you know, if you put parallel, I wasn't doing that. Wasn't doing anything good like that. I might have been, you know, charging up my, I might have been oiling my saxophone or something during that time.
Right,
I wasn't
right.
playing it. I wasn't playing it. So, Joel, I always like to end the episode with something good. This is all good stuff, but sometimes tapping into the emotions of guests and listeners can be inspiring, but it can be jarring. So, imagine young Joel, and you were running for your life from that scary witch on Halloween. What would he think about the work you're doing today? Have you made him proud? And what leadership roles do you have on your sights next?
It's a really great question. I think Jeremy would be in awe. I think he would be like, wow, we did all this? That's incredible. Mm-hmm. I also think he'd be really, really happy. I think I spent a lot of my time as a kid asking adults why, and also asking them why not. Why can't things be this way? Why can't we stop this? Why can't we start this? And I remember I used to ask these questions to teachers, to other adults, and I would get a lot of, well, that's just the way things are. And so I think younger me would be really proud that I didn't accept that's just the way things are.
That's powerful.
And
that's powerful. Thank you. You're making him proud. You're making me proud.
Yeah, I hope so.
We're both making little us's proud. Little me would be like, what? You're doing what? But now she's like, oh, girl, we got this. We got this.
But in terms of what's next, you know, it's been four and a half years since I became founding ED of OJTA. We've grown from a staff of two to a staff of eight. And I think we have plans to expand to probably, you know, 10, 11, and then more plans. So I think for now, I feel responsible for continuing to steward the alliance. Because
mm-hmm.
I think a lot of the times we really personalize this work and say, this is my work, this is me. And I try not to see things that way. I try to see things as, you know, this is work that we have to steward, right? This is work that was passed on to us from other people and that we're going to have to pass on to others.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't belong to us. And I feel that way about the Alliance. I feel the way about all this work is that I am part of something that's much larger than myself. And yes, I have a lot of influence on what happens and how it gets done, but eventually, whether it be because of time or age or me being needed in a different part of the band, I'm going to have to pass the mantle on. And so, but for now, I feel like I'm playing the right instrument, I'm in the right band. And I was called to it. I think that's another big part of it too, is I think a lot of folks see their job and their careers as things that they choose. And I think we would do better to remind ourselves that we do nothing alone. And so when I took this job, I kind of was voluntold to do it. You know, I got poked and prodded by people who mentored me and people whose opinions I respected. And I think that's a really great way to approach leadership, is not necessarily something to reach for, but something that we're asked to meet the moment or to step up to the plate or to meet a need. So we'll see what happens next. We'll see where I get called to step into next.
I'm excited to see. I want you to stay where you are for a little bit so we can keep working with you, but yeah, I'm excited to see where this goes with you as well, Joel, because you're young and you're doing massive things, and the world is better because you're here. So thank you very much for all that you do and for picking up that instrument and playing it. Thank you. Mm-hmm. So Joel, thank you so much for visiting with me today. I appreciate sharing not only this space with you, but for being a partner with OJTA to make changes throughout the vulnerable communities in Oregon. And I say vulnerable, not because I think these communities are weak, but because they have made to be vulnerable. Thank you all so much for listening to this episode. I'll talk to you next time. Bye-bye.
Thank you.